Hi, Christ Church. I'm Shane Bishop, your senior pastor. We're continuing our series on next year people. Today, we're going to look at work. I'm ready to go. Let's get at it. On April Fool's Day, 1988, an unknown singer by the name of Tracy Chapman released a song called Fast Car. It was a folk rock sort of thing, but it was frankly her story that captivated me. Poor African American, trapped on the wrong side of the American dream, Chapman sang about the hope of turning things around. And it was captured in this lyric, "Move out of the shelter and into the suburbs." It was an insight into a world I did not know. And frankly, a world I could barely imagine. A world of frustration and struggle where people seemed trapped and they couldn't break free. And yet, there's hope in the song. There's always hope. And Chapman's metaphor is a fast car, a vehicle that could speed right through all those interlocking systems of oppression that are the most real things in the world to some people and not even seen by others. Take a listen to Fast Car. This next year series is about hope. So I want to suggest that hope is not just something that we need during the occasional life storm, but hope is something we need all the time. It's not just something we need at church, and it's not just something we need at home. Hope is something we need at work as well. You see, I feel like that we need to feel like that we're working toward, not just working for. I talk to so many people who feel trapped and hopeless in their work life. Some feel shut out, others feel locked in. Sometimes these conversations are about struggles at work, but more often, they're bigger than that. They're about the struggle of work. Many have this sense that work should be so much better. They have this vision of what work should be or could be for them. But they can't navigate their way from the realities of their is to get to this ought that they have in their minds. There's a lot of people today who spend every day of their life just dreaming of a fast car to take them away from jobs that leave them empty. Christian people, I think, struggle with this more than most, because I think we intrinsically seem to know that work should be more than a TGIF existence. You guys know what I'm talking about on the TGIF life. On Fridays, I normally gas up my cars and take care of things, and I'm always, it seems like, in a convenience store somewhere. And as you're in the convenience store, I'm always in line, and there's always, on Fridays, there's this huge line in front of me, and it's people that are buying three things, huge 24-packs of beer, lottery tickets, and cigarettes. And it's just a TGIF existence. They have drudged through yet another week, but thank God it's Friday. The weekend's going to come, and at least I can drink some beer and smoke some cigarettes, and who knows, maybe the lottery ticket will be that fast car. When people are feeling frustrated about work, I've noticed it's seldom a thing that's holding them back. It's really related and interlocking things. And I think it's so good in some ways. I know some of you probably struggle with your vocational life, but I think it's a good thing that you haven't just capitulated into the TGIF life. You know that there should be more. And what I want to tell you today is you're right. What you intrinsically feel is correct. There should be more to work than just drudging through all week so you can make it to the weekend and hope to get lucky by winning the lottery and dull your pain just a little bit. When I talk to people who feel trapped at work, I hear seven things over and over. Number one, they feel trapped because they're in debt and because they have financial issues. They can't afford to make a change in their own minds. They feel trapped by their own financial situation. Secondly, some people feel trapped by family obligations. Maybe it's caring for adults or for parents who are aging or children who are still in the home, adult children. Whatever it is, they feel that they're trapped by family obligations. Certainly, Tracy Chapman sang about that. Third, people just feel a lack of opportunity. They don't feel there's any upward mobility where they work, and there's nothing that makes them think tomorrow could be better than today. No matter how hard I work, I'm not going to get anywhere. Number four, there are systemic barriers. And these come into play in a lot of ways. They come into play with things like gender and things like race and all of those kind of things that are these systemic barriers that some people are held back their whole lives and other people don't even see at all. Number five, people feel trapped in oppressive work cultures. There's something about the culture that seems to devalue who they are and what they're about, and they feel trapped. Number six, they feel trapped because they have either a lack of education or a lack of marketable skills. They really, truly don't have any clue as to how things could be any better for them. So it's sort of, you get what you get and don't throw a fit. And then number seven, there's this lack of fulfillment. And that's probably what I hear the most. A lot of people say, I just don't feel fulfilled. I don't see any purpose. I feel like I'm wasting those 40 or 50 hours a week of my life. Let's take a look theologically at work. The Bible opens in the book of Genesis with this massive work project. It's called creation. God created the physical world. He did so in 6 units of time. And on the Sabbath, he rested. God invents the weekend. So what God does in creation, he infused existence with matter and space and time. Existence, which already seems to have been there in some way, is now filled with matter, with space, and with time. First thing we get in the Bible is a work week. And what I need you to understand is this is before the fall. This is a good thing. God gives us the example of a work week. Then the pinnacle of God's creation are called human beings. These wonderful and diverse creatures that are made in the very image of God. And to these exceptional beings, God provided a home. And it was called the Garden of Eden. In a sense, God planted the people in the garden. They are caretakers of the garden. They grew with the garden. They live in perfect harmony with both their creator and that which has been entrusted to them. It is this beautiful, sublime kind of relationship. The work of humans seems to simply be with God. And doing God's work is something that comes naturally to them. It's not a struggle for them in the garden. It's a good gig, but it's based upon obedience. And human beings, we have this thing about us. We don't want most everything. We want everything. And so often we end up with nothing because of it. You see, we weren't content to be gods, God apostrophe S. We wanted to be small g gods of our own life. So we weren't content to be gods, we wanted to be our own gods. We didn't want to answer to anybody. So we rebelled. Enter sin into the world. In Genesis 3, we see the account of the fall of humanity. And in that, everything changes about the relationship between God and the garden and the humans for which the garden was created. All of a sudden, Adam and Eve are locked out. They are banished. And the ground outside the garden is now cursed. Life outside the garden bore little resemblance to life inside the garden. And now there are thorns and thistles mixed in. What was easy got hard. And work shifts from something delightful and natural into this ongoing struggle, this ongoing scrap simply for existence. They're going to have to battle the ground just to survive. If the mantra of pristine creation was life is beautiful, so live beautifully, the mantra of a fallen world is life is hard and then you die. But there's also some hope for humanity and God's judgment. Just because work is harder doesn't mean that work is impossible. Just because we are not in perfect union with God does not mean we can't find places of harmony. Just because it's a difficult thing now doesn't mean it can't still be rewarding. It doesn't mean it can't still be fulfilling. There's still going to be grain to eat among the thorns and the thistles. And God is still going to love humanity. But all of a sudden, people have to work. And it goes from a natural thing to something we're going to just have to do. And we're going to have to work hard. I want to begin our journey into vocation and how to find hope in our vocation by dispelling two myths that are common among Christian people. Myth number one, or fantasy number one, is working at a church is a perfect job. Fantasy number two, being in full-time missions is a perfect job. What I want to suggest to you is that these are callings, but they are very difficult callings. They are rare callings. They are unique callings. And what they are not are fast cars. First of all, fantasy part one. I've noticed over the years that everyone wants to work in a church except the people who actually work at a church. You see, people think working at a church is like church camp, and it is. But it's not like going to church camp, it's like working at church camp. Have you ever noticed what camp workers do? In the summer of 1984 and 1985, when I was a school teacher and a coach, I worked those summers at Epworth United Methodist Camp in Louisville, Illinois. And I'm going to tell you right now, it was a horrible job. Horrible. Church camp workers mow, trim, cook, clean, repair, dig up busted water lines, fix toilets, field complaints, tend to the injured, homesick, and ailing, and do every dirty job imaginable. Working at a church camp is like is spending quality time with a steamer cleaning 30-year-old cloth mattresses that have suffered the wrath of generations of incontinent Methodist children. And I'm not even talking about how they smell. People who work at a church camp do really difficult tasks so the campers can have really wonderful experiences with Jesus. The people who work at Christ Church do the same for you. We build the fire pits, cut down the trees, split the logs, bring in the hay bales, tend the fire, take the complaints, tune up the guitar, practice the songs, plan the devotion, provide the hot dogs and s'mores so you can sing God of Wonders Beyond. And so you can have a great spiritual experience every time you come here. And we love doing this. We love doing this, but it's not easy. You see, working at a church is a sacred calling, but it's not an easy job, and it's not a stress-free job. Sitting around a campfire, singing God of Wonders is fantastic. Providing that experience is hard work. You have an incredible church staff here, and I hope that you appreciate them. I hope that you encourage them, because you are so blessed. But it's a hard job. The second fantasy is that so many people want to be in full-time missions, despite the fact that almost no one who's not employed by a church or a formal parachurch ministry is in full-time mission. I've had hundreds of conversations over the years, and they go roughly like this. Somebody goes on a mission trip to a country somewhere, and they have an incredible experience. They go back, and they have an incredible experience. They go back, and they start getting ideas for maybe some things they could do or how things could be done better. And they get a heart for having a ministry there. That's good, it's proper, and it's wonderful. My dad started going to Honduras decades and decades ago. Literally dozens of ministries have come out of that through this process and this cycle. Well, then they start sharing their vision with some other people, and people gravitate around that. They put a mission trip or two together. People have wonderful, wonderful experiences. It's all good. And then so often these leaders get thinking, wouldn't it be great if I could do this full time? Wouldn't it be great if this was my job? And then they come and talk to me, and I sort of get a pen out and just pop their balloons. And this is what I tell them. I say, you know what? People will pay to go on a mission trip because it's of value. But do you offer enough value to someone's life the other 355 days of the year that they are going to support you? That they're going to cover your salary and your insurance and all of those things? What I tell them is that that type of relationship is very, very rare. It very seldom happens in real time. That's why that 99% of all people who had missions ministries, those organized mission ministries, 99% of them are going to have to keep their day job. And here's what I need you to hear. That is fine. That is a biblical model. That's a good thing. There's nothing wrong with having a day job and having a sense of calling to a ministry. The journey into vocational ministry can be pretty tough. Sometimes people look at me and they say, well, I want to do what you do. I've had several people over the years that said, I feel called to ministry. And I said, well, what do you feel called to? They said, I want to do what you do. And I always look at them and I say, almost nobody does what I do. I mean, almost nobody does what I do. The average United Methodist Church runs about 75. So if you're telling me you want to be ordained clergy in the Methodist Church, you're probably going to start out in a church even smaller than that. We are almost twice as large as the second largest Methodist church in Illinois. So nobody's really doing what I do. So what you need to ask yourself is what's God calling you to do? And then I tell them a little bit about my journey. And I'm guessing my journey might be a little different than you might think. When I was a teacher and a coach from 1984 until 1986, at North Clay Junior High School in Louisville, I truly felt I was being used by God. Those of you that are in education, I think it is such an incredible vocation. I mean, nobody expected it from me. Nobody expected their basketball coach or their baseball coach or their history teacher, 22 years old, to be passionately in love with Jesus. Now, I was immature, and the stresses were difficult for me to handle at that young age, but I would have gotten used to that. I would have gotten better at that. And I truly felt like that I impacted in positive ways the students and the athletes and my fellow teachers. I truly felt God's pleasure in that vocation. And yet 2 years later, I resigned. I went to graduate school. And I accepted a teaching assistant at SIU Carbondale while I worked on a master's degree. And the question is why? Why did I leave something that I was enjoying doing that was going really, really well? And the answer is that I had this undeniable feeling inside that wasn't what God had for me. It was great. And God was going to have that for a lot of people. But I didn't exactly know what God had for me, but I didn't feel it was that. So we went another direction in our life. But we had made some pretty good decisions that allowed us to do that. First of all, we'd rented a home. We didn't own a home. We were not in debt. And I had some marketability. So the reality is we didn't need a fast car. A regular one would do just fine. We kept ourselves in position to change lanes if we needed to. And yet, this is not necessarily a happily ever after kind of story. It's not like you make one decision and things go great. After receiving a master's degree at SIU Carbondale, I felt God's call in the ministry. That was really a difficult thing because I had a freshly minted master's degree. Now I was going to have to go across the country to Emory University and spend 3 years to get another master's degree. It made no sense to me other than I felt like God was calling me to do it. And guess what? We did it. Except this time, I had to get student loans to be able to afford Emory University. I took a church as a pastor that paid $11,000 a year. We sold everything we couldn't carry, including my baseball card collection, and we moved to Georgia. Those 3 years were incredibly lean for Melissa and I, and Zach was in kindergarten, and Lydia was just a little bitty thing. But upon graduation, I truly assumed that there would just be a fast car waiting for me. We'd been obedient. We took the big chance. We did things that made no sense. And I kind of thought that fast car would be there. And yet what I got in many ways was a rude awakening. After seminary, we moved back to Illinois, and I served under appointment at Sumner. I was there a total of 5 years before I moved here. I've only served two places as a pastor in Illinois. But after a couple years at Sumner, I'd served my probation time for the conference. I had seminary in. I'd taken my psychologicals. I'd done all my paperwork. And all I had left to be fully ordained was an interview that I thought would just go terrifically. It was at Little Grassy Campgrounds, of all things, down in southern Illinois. And I just thought this was sort of a perfunctionary thing. In fact, I expected a lot of affirmation. My churches at Sumner and Beulah were doing exceptionally well. I had no indication that there were any problems anywhere. I expected to get a lot of affirmation at this interview. What I got was utterly blindsided. I mean, out of nowhere, I was 2 minutes into this, and I thought, this is going to be really, really bad. And it was really, really bad. Instead of getting an A+ and you head on in, I got a, you know what? We're not sure about you. We're not sure about you. We're going to defer you. We're going to just put you off a while. We're going to give you a bunch of stuff to do. And if you do it, you come back. And maybe we'll let you through. It was a really, really difficult thing for me. I was so sure about it. I had made dinner reservations for my whole extended family. And we were going to celebrate. I didn't have any money, but we were going to celebrate. I mean, it was embarrassing. It was horrible. I felt like we followed you. I felt like the disciples in that boat on the storm at the Sea of Galilee, where they wake up Jesus and they said, "Don't you care that we're about to die?" I felt like that in every way. For a full year, that deferment just filled my head. I can't tell you how many hundreds of times I ran that interview, that horrible interview, over in my mind. And the pain bled into every area of my ministry and every area of my life. And then I remember the night that I decided I was just going to leave the United Methodist Church. They didn't want me. Boom. I didn't want to be a part of it. It's about 9 o'clock in the evening. And in my own heart, I had made that decision. And our phone rang. This is back when people had phones that were connected to their homes. They didn't move. The phone rang. If you were there, you picked it up. Stayed in one place. Melissa brought the phone to me, and it was Reverend Dwight Jones, a really respected pastor and superintendent. He'd never called me before, and there he was on the other side of the phone, and he said, "Shane, I don't really know why I felt prompted to call you. I know it's late, but I just wanted to tell you that I feel God has big plans for you in the United Methodist Church, and I just wanted to share that with you. Don't even know why. But God has big plans for you." Dwight hung up completely unaware of the pivotal role that he played concerning my vocational life. God sent Dwight to rescue me from a decision that probably would have taken me out of God's will. After sitting out the ordination process the following year, I was still in a pretty bad mood. I went through the next year and everything went as well as I thought they would have gone 2 years prior. And you say, well, the rest has been history, right? They've all lived happily ever after. Well, we're just starting our third decade here at Christ Church. Clearly, God has blessed this congregation. I mean, we have grown for 21 consecutive years. Who has that? I assure you, there have been some gut-wrenching stretches of highway here. I've earned every one of these gray hairs, and deep in my heart, I don't even blame all the hairs in the back of my head that have just abandoned ship. I love what I do. I love what I do here, but it is not easy. And at times, it's been absolutely excruciating. Work will never be easy in a fallen world. No matter what you're doing, it will never be easy in a fallen world. I'd like to share with you some words of hope concerning work. If you're taking notes, I got 7 of them. Just write 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, hope at work. How do we find hope at work? Number one, I want you to know work should be more than a necessary evil. So those of you that intrinsically think work should be more than it is, you are right. It should be. For Christian people, it should be more than a necessary evil. Otherwise, we're wasting 40 or 50 hours a week of our lives doing something that doesn't matter. It should be more. Number two, this is for those of you that love your jobs and work at it about 70 hours a week. Work is a terrible God. Work is a terrible God. Your company may love you as long as you're making them a lot more money than they're paying you, but I will tell you, when their usefulness for you runs out, they will toss you out and they will not think twice about it. Companies do not love us. God loves us. Our families love us. Work is a terrible God. Number three, bivocational ministry is biblical. So those of you that kind of have a sense of ministry, you got something you do. Yeah, I understand you wish you could do it full time, but there's really not a biblical category for that. The reality is even Paul, who came the closest to it, even Paul is having to stop sometimes and make tents. So bivocational ministry is a biblical model. That's a good thing. Number four, you need to keep your options open. If God should ask you to do something else, could you? When I say keep your options open, I'm talking about living within your means. I'm talking about if you're unsure about your future, you need to avoid debt. You need to avoid long-term contracts. I know people who God called to missions or to a mission field in some way, but they had to delay for 2 or 3 years to try to get out of all their commitments. So if you feel like God may be calling you, if you feel like something may change, keep your options open. Get in a position where you could follow God if he asked. Number five, if you hate what you do, do something else. And I'm really serious. If you hate what you do, do something else. You say, I can't afford it. Well, maybe you can't afford to live as well as you do now and do it. But if you had to downsize and you were going to be a whole lot happier and more fulfilled, would that not be worth it? Is stuff really worth being miserable all of the time? Number six, pursue meaning at work. Ask yourself, how can I find meaning in what I do? Some of you may be doing things that are meaningful. Certainly when I was a teacher, I felt like I was doing something meaningful. I was trying to educate kids, help them think, learn them, teach them to connect actions and consequences. I felt that was meaningful. I know all jobs, people don't necessarily feel like that what they do has intrinsic meaning. But I can tell you, you can find meaning at work. For example, are there people that you can pray for at work? Are there people that you can reach out to that God could use you at work? Is it possible that you could start a Bible study or some kind of prayer group at work? Just being a good example can be a powerful thing. Maybe you don't have a job that challenges you in every way, but you're in there, you work hard, you got a good attitude. People know that you're a Christian. They know that you go to Christ Church. You can be a powerful witness just with that skill set. Speaking into the lives of people. Work throws us into the gravitational pull of people we'd probably never be around if we were given our own choice. How can that become an opportunity to speak into life? Think about what you provide, what your work actually provides people. A lot of jobs provides people things they need, and that's an important thing. And finally, what about this? Money to tithe. You make money at work, you tithe that, you invest that into God's work in this world. And so work has meaning because you're able to give to God. So look for ways to find meaning and transform meaning into your work life. And then number seven, just start praying about work. I hear people complain about work all the time. I just don't think very many people pray about it. Pray that God could use you in unexpected ways. Pray that God would be glorified through you. Pray that you could be a great example. Pray for your company. If they're doing good things and they're doing it the right way, pray that God would bless them. You can be an instrument of God's blessing in your workplace. So I've got three questions I'd like to ask you to kind of think about concerning work. For everybody here, but particularly if you're maybe just a little frustrated in your work life and you need a little hope. Number one, what are three specific ways that you serve God at work? A lot of times, if we sit and think about it, we're actually doing better than we think. So write down three ways that you serve God at work. You could serve God by being a good Christian example. You could serve God by speaking into the lives of others. You could serve God because you're providing a service of some kind. Three ways that you serve God at work. Number two, what are three intentional things you could do to make work more meaningful and more fulfilling? Just three intentional things. Could you start a prayer group? Could you start a Bible study? Could you look for more opportunities to share faith? Could you look for more opportunities to pray with people? Could these things happen? So what are three intentional things you could do to make work more fulfilling and more meaningful? And then number three, if you don't like your work situation, if you're kind of in a dead end kind of place, needing a fast car, I get that. We all get there. What steps can you begin to take to create a better reality for yourself? Maybe it's just getting out of debt. Maybe it's just creating some financial room so you save up so you can afford to go to school. It's those kind of things. Now, we've been talking all throughout this series about how next year people encounter storms. So I want to close with these five things we've been looking at for the whole series and talk about how they can apply to us at work when storms tend to come. Number one, when you have a work storm, just stop. Stop. This is such an important life skill. Stop. When you're lost, don't speed up. Stop. Number two, control your impulses. Control your impulses. Don't make things worse. Keep your mouth shut. Keep your fingers away from your keyboard or your phone. Just don't make things worse. Control your impulses. Number three, think. Just think your situation through. What do you have going for you? What do you need to have in order to have some better options? Think your situation through. Consider your alternatives. Number four, choose. Choose. You see, where frustration sets in, where hopelessness sets in, is where we feel we have no control over our lives. You have control over your life. And you can make choices about that. If I feel like I have options and I'm making choices, my reality sits one way. If I feel like I have no options and I have no choices, hopelessness begins to gnaw at me. So, choose. What is your course of action? What is your plan? And I love to ask people that when they talk about vocation. I say, what's your plan? They'll say, well, I'm going to quit my job. That's not a plan. What is your plan? And then number five, just act. Run your offense. Be disciplined about that. Execute your plan. These are really, really important life skills. Vocation should be meaningful. There should be purpose. And I believe that as you pray about it, I think you can begin to find some of that no matter where you are, no matter what you do. Maybe some of you are in areas that aren't where God would have you. They're not in your best area. Sometimes difficulty can actually open new windows. I've known a lot of people that were in dead-end jobs, and for whatever reason, they lost those jobs. They went back to school, took a step backward, ended up getting a whole lot better job, and as they look back through their life, losing that job, which they thought was a storm, ends up being the best thing ever happened to them. So here's how I want to close this up. For most people, vocation is a journey. It's just a journey. It takes a lot of shapes and forms throughout their lives. Young people today are rolling through a lot of jobs. In my parents' generation, a lot of people would just start working for a company when they were young, work their whole life for that company, draw a pension, and retire. That was it. It's a lot more complicated today. It's a lot more liquid today. It takes a lot of shapes and forms. But I want to suggest that work should be a whole lot more than simply enduring the week so that you can get to the weekend hoping to find a fast car and dull your pain and have a good time. God has a plan for your life. A real-time plan. God has gifted you with certain skills and gifts that will enable you to fulfill that plan. You see, God doesn't just have a plan for your life. God has a wonderful plan for your life. You were created for purpose. And God wants you to live a life of purpose and power and peace and passion, not just when you come to church and not just at home, but also when you are at work. Hope. Hope is the substance, or faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not yet seen. Faith is not based on a pipe dream. Faith is based on hope. And hope isn't just this feeling that one day a fast car is going to show up and supernaturally take you wherever it is you're supposed to be. Hope is a lot harder work than that. Hope is understanding that you are loved, you are forgiven. God has a plan for your life. You've got a mind. You can think through a plan. You can make choices, and you can get where God has called you to be by God's Holy Spirit. My friends, if work is tough for you right now, don't lose hope. Stop. Control your impulses. Think. Choose. Act. God has big plans for you. Would you pray with me? Great and mighty God, thank you that we are not hopeless. And thank you, dear God, that where we are, if it's not where you would have us to be, that there is always a way, that you, dear God, make a way, even where there seems to be no way. And thank you that you love us and you care about us. And forgive us when we feel despair. Forgive us when we cry out to you, do you not care about us? Forgive us, dear God, where our own choices hem us in when you have created us to be free. So I pray for everybody here that's struggling in their work life. I pray, dear God, that you would speak directly to them and they would indeed find a future and a hope that is found in Christ and Christ alone. In Jesus' strong name, amen.